Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we'll hear those stories.
This edition of Galley Tables was recorded on February 5th, 2016, at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. The theme was Where the Wild Things Are.
Toby Sullivan came to Kodiak when he was 19, and he has been a commercial fisherman ever since. He retired from winter crab fishing and trawling some years ago, but continues to fish his salmon set net site in Euganic Bay and has since the early 1980s. He is also an executive director at the Kodiak Maritime Museum. Please welcome him onto the stage.
Hello. Thanks for everybody for coming out. It's a full house. It's kind of cool. So, a long time ago, when I was a younger guy than you see before you now, I found myself in Nepal, in the Himalayas, trekking around Annapurna Massif, which is a giant pile of mountains about 40 miles across that has the biggest mountain in this pile, in this massif, is Annapurna 1, which is 26,000 feet high. And to put that into perspective, Mount Everest is 29,000 and Denali is 20,000. So this is a big pile of rock here. So I was trekking around this. You can do it a circuit. It takes about 2 weeks. And I was traveling with two other young gentlemen, such as myself. We were backpackers, a guy from California and a guy from Canada. And we took the bus from Kathmandu, and we got off, and we started hiking north. And after about a week of climbing up and up and up every day and staying in little guest houses and in people's farmhouses and the barn with the animals, things like that, you cross a pass called Tharong La, which is 17,800 feet. And it's the pass between the mountains. So that's how big the mountains are. And on the backside to the south is the Indian subcontinent. It's moist, it's wet, it's India, filled with people. And to the north is the Tibetan plateau, which is dry and very foreign. And you cross into another world. Then you go down 8,000 feet, and you're into this big valley called the Kali Kandaki Gorge. And we walk down this valley with Tibet to the right and the Annapurna Massif to the left. And a couple days into that part of it, we stopped at a village one day for lunch, and there was a man there talking to the villagers. And this guy had a big head of a wild head of gray hair and a big beard, and he was wearing a loincloth and nothing else. And he had a staff and a wooden bowl, a begging bowl. And he had all these villagers around him, and he was just talking. And I recognize this kind of a guy as what they call a sadhu. I'd seen these guys in India. And what they are is, these are people who have really tried to gain knowledge about what we're up to on this planet. And in the Hindu tradition, they believe that you go through reincarnation until you get it right. And then you are released from the wheel of life. So sadhus are people who got it right and have been released from the wheel of life. And they are now in a state of nirvana or enlightenment. But instead of going on and not having to come back to this veil of tears, they've chosen to give their place in line to someone else less worthy, and they come back and they try to help people on Earth to achieve all that they can be. So that's who this guy was. And he was talking to these villagers. And when he got done talking and walked off, I asked one of these guys, so, you know, what did he tell you? Because it was all in Nepali, and this guy could speak English here. And he goes, he told us how to live. So I was like, that's pretty cool. And we're on the backside of Annapurna by now, up against Tibet. So we walked along, and then a few more days, we had one more day in the mountains before we would descend to where the road was and catch a bus back to Kathmandu, back to the regular world. And we had one more night out, and we're walking down this valley to where we're going to stay. And on the left, as you walk down, is this huge mountain called Machu Picchu. It's called the Fishtail Mountain. It's 22,000 feet high, 2,000 feet higher than Denali. And it just sticks out of the landscape. It doesn't have any mountains around it, so it really stands up. and has these huge flat faces of black basalt with glaciers on some sides. It looks like one of those buildings with the angle on the top like this. And because of the flat face like this, it looks like a fishtail. It really does. But it's a monstrous presence in the world as you walk down. So we have this all afternoon on our left shoulder as we go down. And then we get to this little farmhouse, and this woman and her daughters, they have a place in the barn for us, and she serves food. So we throw our stuff in back, we come out, and there's this dining table. And the evening, the sun has set, it's now early evening, and in the room are these four Irish people and two Japanese guys. And we all eat the food, it's rice and dal bhat and chapatis. It's all good, very basic third world food, but it's good. And out the window is Machu Picchu, the Fishtail Mountain, the moon shining on it, this brilliant stars. I mean, it's the kind of stuff you pay a lot of money to go see. I didn't have a lot of money, and we'd walk to get there, but still. So we finish dinner, and then this woman brings out this bottle of clear liquid, kind of like that, only it was not water. This stuff called Rakshi, which is like Nepali moonshine. And she puts it on the table with all these little cups, and we start telling stories. And me and these two other guys, we're young, and we don't really have that many stories, but these Irish people are from Dublin, and they've been 6 months out of Ireland. And they've come across Ireland and across Europe and Asia Minor through Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and they end up here, and they're on a pilgrimage to the Guinness Brewery in Singapore. And then we ask these Irish people, these two Japanese guys, what are you up to? And then one guy, he said, well, I speak English, and my partner doesn't. We do have a story, and he's going to sing the story. And we're like, that sounds good. Let's have another shot. And this man stands up. He starts to sing this song in Japanese, and his partner is translating. And the story is, when he was a little boy, his father was a mountain climber. And his father decided to climb Machu Picchu, the Fishtail Mountain. And before he left, the night before he left, he sang this song to his family. He said, my beloved wife, my children, I'm going to climb the Fishtail Mountain. And it's a dangerous mountain, but I'm a mountain climber, and that's what I do to fulfill myself, to be all that I can be in this life. I accept the danger, and I hope that you will too, and know that if I don't come back from Machu Picchu Day, don't cry for me, because I died on the mountain doing what I wanted to do. And the tears are coming down, and we're all like, what happened? And this guy goes, well, of course, his father didn't come back, and his father's still up on the mountain, and we're here, we're going up there tomorrow, not to the top, but up on the mountain just to see where his father was lost in the avalanche. And at that point, we all did another shot, and this Japanese guy stood up and he yelled, Machu Picchu Day. He drank the shot, we drank our shots, and then we all went to bed. Thanks.
Borgie Holm is a third-generation Alaskan fisherman's daughter. She was born in Kodiak and works at the Kodiak Assembly of God and the Kodiak Crisis Pregnancy Center. For fun, she likes looking at wild plants, fishing, and writing, and sometimes she is a missionary globetrotter.
Peace is tenuous. Travel to the Democratic Republic of Congo is strongly discouraged by the United States State Department. These were the words that greeted me as I began researching an upcoming journalism trip to the DRC. My friend, who is a much more experienced journalist, told me, if a country in Africa calls itself democratic, you can bet it really isn't. And in fact, DRC is a dictatorship, one of the most corrupt countries in the world. Also, at that time, it was rated as one of the most dangerous countries in the world for women in particular, and I was to be the only woman on a team of four. Upon entry into the DRC, in an 8-by-8-foot room, suddenly my passport mysteriously disappeared. It had been there just seconds ago. I had no idea what was happening. I couldn't understand the customs official, but he was becoming angrier and angrier. We searched frantically through the room trying to find the passport. I began to feel terror like I've never felt before welling up inside of me. Why was my passport gone, the only woman in the group? Was I ever going to go home again? Was I going to go to one of those prison camps I had read about? Was I going to see my mom? I forced myself not to cry because they would see my weakness if they were trying to play some kind of a trick on us. But then as quickly as it had disappeared, the passport resurfaced inside of a book on the official's desk. We left as if nothing had happened and it was all fine. As we entered the city, we learned what peace is tenuous means. It means that tanks patrol the streets. It means that UN peacekeepers man gun turrets with rifles aimed at the street if anything gets out of hand. It means that compounds are guarded by razor wire, and that as white people, we can't go anywhere without being robbed or possibly killed without our local escorts. Further into the time we began our interviews in the city, the people told us things that we had no boxes in our minds to contain. We felt like we couldn't understand them, even though we heard the words from them, because we had never experienced war. They told us things like massacre, slaughter, systematic rape. Even children were not exempt from the bloodshed, and the world was silent. The world didn't care, even though it was hundreds of thousands of people. I couldn't understand how these people were even still standing. I didn't know how to help them. I wanted to hold their hands and feel their pain, but I was thankful that I couldn't. I thought about the word conflict that I heard all the time. The word conflict sounded like somebody fighting over who had to do the dishes that night. It didn't sound like what these people were describing to me. But there was another side to the story. We met church members who had hidden opposing tribe members in order to save their lives during the warfare. The people were risking their own lives to save their brothers. And it would be their own tribes that would kill them for protecting the enemy if they were found out. And then we met a Bible translator whose story was the most powerful of all. He talked about when the soldiers came and ransacked his village, and he was separated from his wife and his daughter as they fled into the jungle. It was many days before he found them again, and when he did, they were just weeping. They clung to him. They wouldn't say a word. They would do nothing but cry. Finally, he got them to tell him what had happened, and the soldiers had raped his wife and his daughter. But that day, as he spoke to us, he said with a voice as calm and clear as a cool well, "I have forgiven those soldiers, and I pray for them." My team could not understand. We were astonished. I puzzled in my mind how a person could possibly forgive these things. What could be worse for a husband and a father than to forgive that? After a while, I realized that it was simply a miracle, and it was not something that could be explained or understood. It was something that was simply granted. Soon afterwards, we went to the village of Bogoro. This was the site of a massacre. The people responsible for it were on trial at the International Criminal Court at The Hague, standing trial for their epic crimes against humanity. In one day, they had killed 60% of the people of this village. But it was a peaceful and beautiful setting that greeted us when we came. The women were digging in the garden, replanting. There were beautiful green shoots growing from the ground, like signs of hope. They were starting over again. Against all odds, this village was going to survive. The women's beautiful, colorful dresses blew in the breeze, and I squatted in the soil next to them, and through smiles and gestures, I learned how to help them weed. It was all I could do to try to help after what they had gone through. Soon afterward, I stood in a schoolhouse that had been bombed. Brick rubble was now being overtaken by foliage, and the sun was shining in. It was actually peaceful and beautiful. And not long afterwards, our last stop in the village, we met with the village elders. They told us how they were rebuilding the village with people of every tribe so that no one could cause division ever again. It would be everyone's village, and they would squelch any troublemakers that caused division. Before we left, these people from once warring tribes sat together in peace and sang a hymn. Back at my host's home, his two young children spotted my little brown birthmark poking out from under my dress on my shin. They asked me what it was. And I said, "Well, when God was making me, he was also painting a Congolese person next to me. and that is where he splashed me with your paint. Without missing a beat, they held out their fingertips to me and said, Auntie Borgie, this is where he dipped us in your paint, showing their glowing white nail beds. I thought to myself, how if more people in the world could celebrate our differences like me and Amoti and Akiki, rather than despising them, perhaps it would hasten the day when the promise from Scripture would be fulfilled, the promise from the prophet Micah that says, and they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. They will not learn or practice war anymore.
So next up is Drew North, and he was born in Montclair, and he came by way of the Kodiak Baptist Mission. He cooks for work, along with various other duties, and for fun, he hangs out with his wife. He is just living life and loving people. Please welcome him on the stage.
So where do we find our wild things? Apparently you find them in Tibet, in Africa. Well, for me, it started, even now. It's waiting in line to get into Gala Tables. Jumping up on here on stage. So that's where we find our wild things. For me, it started, just like everyone else, running out the back door, playing in the yard, jumping in the pool, going on vacations and ventures, and just following after what you do. Here we are in the ultimate wild place called Kodiak, Alaska. There's a lot of things to do, a lot of things to keep our mind, our days busy, and that's what we do. When I was young, my brother used to race mountain bikes up in Mammoth and just cross country stuff, and we were at a campsite on the backside of Sierra Nevadas in California. And, everyone thinks California is this one big city or whatever you want. But it's very wild and, it's pretty cool. So, the story goes is one day, so here's our campsite. We have the tent trailer, then we have our neighbors. Apparently the neighbors didn't go to camping school. Because they had, the coolers out and all that kind of stuff. And the day before, on the campground, they're like, bears and, watch out for your bears, Definitely wild. So that night, our family goes to bed. My brother Joel sleeps outside because that's how he is. I'm in the tent trailer with my family and my dog, Murphy, and I'm just sleeping. It's been a fun day watching bike races up in Mammoth and a bunch of crazies bombing down a 10,000 foot peak on mountain bikes. And we're just enjoying the evening. Well, suddenly our neighbors who didn't go to camping school found out that bears can smell and search out things that us humans like, of course. And here we are, and all I remember is my dog Murphy, who's a terrier, just started barking, and started barking pretty loud, and then my dad gets up, and then I run outside behind my dad, and sure enough, here's a bear just going to town, just going to the buffet, and it's just like, come on, being 12 years old, I really didn't know that much about outdoors yet, but I'm like, two to two, and here's my brother outside sleeping, despite my dog Murphy barking and my dad banging on some pots and the bear going things. So that was definitely wild. Fast forward that a couple years, I agreed to go overseas with Team Missions International to Finland, and where the wild things are, they're everywhere. And our team went from Helsinki to Eisbach, Germany. And that was definitely crazy. I went from a nice, we went from Finland, slept on a boat, slept on some trains, slept in a train station. And I'm like, this is wild, you know, this is really crazy. You know, how do you go from there, you know? Fast forward that a couple more years, Hurricane Rita goes through Texas, watching TV. I'm like, there's something I can do. So, you know, I call up the Red Cross. I'm like, oh, man, hey, I can do something. You know, get trained by the Red Cross. Here I am flying to San Antonio, Texas, meeting our team, and then, you know, running shelter operations in about 110 to 115 degree heat outside of Austin. Once again, for the Southern California boy, that's really hot. You know, and if you guys ever been to Texas, it's just, oh boy, you know, it's just a lot. And, but, each adventure, each wild thing, you know, I've chased after, if it's getting up here on stage tonight or, you know, saying yes or getting on a plane or getting on a train, you know, there's just a lot of things. And, you know, being down in Texas is, yeah, it just really opened up my eyes to see, you know, in the midst of a national tragedy, you know, seeing people from all around the country come together, mishmash together on a team, and just hanging out. Fast forward that, you know, a couple more years, back up here in Kodiak, and, you know, I meet the beautiful Stephanie Ann Cozart, and, you know, she said yes to me 9 days on Valentine's Day last year, and, you know, it's been a little wild, and, I mean, what do I know, you know, we've only been married less than 2 months, but, you know, as a couple, we just want to say yes, from getting up on stage to going up on an adventure, or just whatever we do. So whatever your wild thing is, apparently, you know, going to Tibet, or going to Texas, or saying yes, just enjoy it. And one day, when you're standing in line at Galley Tables, get up on stage.
Bill Hoyt is a carpenter and mason from Maine. He loves the outdoors. That is one of his main passions. And he has worked for 45 years and helped build bridges for island trails. He loves the people and island of Kodiak, but hates the rain.
I kind of got drafted for this, so I just want you to know it could go really bad. No rehearsal. This story's about a canoe trip in northern Maine. How many of you have been to the Brooks Range? Clap, clap. The Brooks Range in northern Maine have a lot in common. There's big fish, there's deer, bear, moose, bugs. Lots of bugs. So a friend of mine, we were carpenters together, he had a habit of putting together these canoe trips. And I'm sure if any of you have been on long distance canoe trips, it's very similar to banging your head against the wall. It feels so great when it's over. But anyway, we sat down at the maps and we looked at all the different possible routes. Well, Maine has some incredible lyrical names, native names for the ponds and the lakes and the streams. Unzaskus is one of them. I really like that one. My favorite is Chemquasitabamtakook. I spent most of my formative years trying to figure out how to pronounce that. But we didn't choose those ponds. We chose a circular route of first, second, third, and fourth Roach Pond. It wasn't an auspicious start. We get to the put-in. We had our DeLorme map, and I did go out with his sister, and he makes a damn good map, but his sister was a lot better. The map showed a stream there. Well, there's kind of a stream, but you couldn't tell by trying to float the canoes in it. So we immediately started portaging. Well, I don't know how many of you have transported gear by foot through mud, over rocks and stumps. And anyway, our expedition former, Paul, was looked at rather askance. I might add there were Paul and his wife, two other couples, and myself and another bachelor, who I'm going to call Cheech, for lack of any other name. And Paul Labrador, the one I'm going to call Chong. Anyway, like I said, when you're desperately trying to find water to float a canoe in, things go downhill. You get sweaty, the black flies. I don't think you're familiar with black flies here, but they bring knives, forks, and spoons, and doggy bags for what's left to take home. So you fight those all day long. It's miserable. Finally, you get enough water to paddle a couple hundred yards, and then it's back to dragging the canoes again. So we were doing this, and then you get to make camp at night. Well, you make it as rapidly as possible, because the mosquitoes come out at sundown. Now, these are big mosquitoes. They're Maine mosquitoes. They can fight Brooks Range mosquitoes. So that's your daily routine. You fight the black flies all day. You try to be friendly with each other, and then you fight the mosquitoes all night. And there's always two or three that get in the pen. So you spend most of the night trying to get those two. But it was going fairly well, except for the lack of water and the fact that two of the couples and Cheech had never been canoeing before. So even when you do find water, it's just a sharp learning curve. So as this epic went on, that's very similar to Kodiak also. You know, you get in the boat, you take off, and pretty soon you're in an epic. You don't even know if you're gonna come home or not. I noticed that as the days progressed, Paul was getting a little worried look on his face, and everybody was looking at him like he might be Captain Bly or a similar character. But we were coping. Now Cheech, he had a habit of, well, he was fond of pharmaceutical recreation. So when I am able to find some water to paddle, he's usually leaning over the paddles, stretched across the gunwales, looking around going, wow, man, beautiful. So that's how my day usually went. And Cheech's other habit was he'd get up in the morning, we'd be around the fire, he'd grab a cup of coffee, down that, and he'd stroll off into the greenery to commute with nature. So I want you to picture this. Here's a man who's basically stoned out of his mind most of the time. And he's sitting, probably toking. And all of a sudden, the bushes explode. He tries to stand, and a massive black animal rips between his legs, grabbing at a sensitive part of the matter as he goes through. The first we became aware of this was a screech. Cheech come bursting through the briars, clutching what he was sure he had just lost. His eyes bulged out over his cheekbones. He's looking at us, he's babbling incoherently. No, nothing can be made out of it, and we're just kind of wondering how he managed to traverse 100 yards of blown down timber with his pants around his ankle was the most immediate question. But then, the greenery shakes again, and out comes Chong. He was very happy with himself. And Cheech finally realized that he was going to be able to father children. So he turned away from us and gets his apparel straightened up. And he walks over, he sits down on the cooler, and he goes, wow, man, beautiful. Shortly after this trip, Paul decided that sailing was a much better option. One, there were no black flies, nobody had to drag the canoes, and the sailboat held a considerably larger payload of beer. So if you ever get a chance to go canoeing in Maine, I would sincerely reconsider.
We're going to have Pete Hanna. He is a former teacher and resident of Australia. He owns an organic blueberry farm in northern Washington and has been a Kodiak fisherman for over 35 years. He enjoys beachcombing, auctions, slowly running the Pillar Mountain Race, traveling, and being with his family. Please give him a warm round of applause.
Some of my wild things live in my car. I have parked my car at my farm, and I go down there once a year, and I get my kids in it, and we drive, start driving down to Bellingham, the nearest town, and people are by us, and they're pointing and honking at me and telling me to pull over on the freeway, so I didn't know what was wrong, and I do. And evidently, the mice had climbed in the tailpipe of the car and packed the muffler completely full of these filberts. And they're starting to get heated up, and they're shooting out for the so I don't really know what to do. But so I just decide I got to get them out. So we sit there, and I floorboard the car. And they heat up, and it's like a 20-minute machine gun. I wish my kids thought were really fun. You know, they were little, they thought it was pretty fun. So then I drive it home that time, and I park it, and I'm going to outsmart these mice, so I put a can over the tailpipe so they can't get in there again. Next year, I go home, and I get in the car, and everything's fine. We're driving down the road in about the same area. I turn the heaters on, and out of both vents came mice. Little mice. And my family didn't know this, but I'm way more scared of mice than I am bears. So we're all out of the car on the freeway, and the mice are coming out. We're all out except for my one son, who's strapped in the car seat. Nobody's willing to go in and get it. So I take the air cleaner off, and there's 20 or so mice still in there in various stages of life. I throw them out, and we drive back to the farm, and I park a car, and nobody wants to get right in that car. And on the way back, every time you turn around to go through a corner, the nuts up in the headliner roll back and forth. And to this day, I mean, I paid $7,000 for that car. It only has 40,000 miles. Nobody will ride it. It's been 15 years. So, but I'm sure you didn't come here to hear a couple mouse stories. So later, Margaret, who's my wife now, but she was my girlfriend at that time and barely became my wife after this trip. We were in northern India, and we went to a wildlife, a park, a national park. I wanted to see some animals. Well, we stopped there, and immediately a Indian guy comes up and wants to be our, tells us that it's not safe to go in the park without a guide. You can get killed. It's very dangerous. And he's 16 years old, and he's going to charge us $4. But I go, hey, you know, I tell Margaret that, you know, we live in a Kodiak. We got bears all around. We don't need any guide going in a little old park. And eventually she agreed, and which was surprising to me. And we went in the park, and we go across the river, and we get in, and immediately there's 12-foot-high elephant grass, and you can see about 1 foot, and there is a little trail, and I'm thinking, maybe I should have got a guide. But we went a little further, and we got in the jungle, and we didn't see that much. So I said, maybe we should climb a tree. So we each climbed a tree to get a little better view. And we looked around, and I wasn't even up there very long, and some movement caught my eye over here next to this big rock, and then another movement, and it wasn't a big rock. It was a rhinoceros. And it was wiggling its ears or wiggling its tail or something, but it was sleeping. But it didn't look that great. It's just a great, big gray thing. So I told her, now I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to get that guy to stand up, and you get a picture of him. He came all this way. So I do, and I, oh boy. So I do, and I take a rock and I throw it at it. And they stood up, and it was rooting around and snorting, and I'm looking at it quite amazed. And, and maybe if I was a guide, I would have known a few things about rhinoceros. Number one, they got a low IQ. But that's relative, you know, if you're comparing them to me at that moment. Number two, they're pretty blind. Three, they got a great sense of smell, great sense of hearing. And all of a sudden, he whipped his head around, and he was about to the end of the room. And he tore out after me so fast, and I was really scared. And I turned around and went to go climb up that tree. And I don't know if there was a monkey in front of me, but if there was, I climbed right over it. And I heard that some people say that when they were scared or excited, you know, that they near wet their pants. I wish I'd only wet. And then it goes away, and I say to Margaret, "Hey, did you see that?" And all I hear is, "I can't believe I came this far with somebody that would do something so stupid." Jeez, I nearly died. You ran down there and threw a rock at a goddamn rhinoceros. How can you do something so similar to that? Well, whatever. It took a long time to get over that. And does that mean 5 minutes or
that's,
seven?
That's seven.
Oh. Well, right after that, we go to Malaysia. We go to a zoo. It's not like American zoo. There's an orangutan walking down the street. His knuckles are dragging on the ground and walking like this. And he didn't look too smart either. He sat down next to the... He sat down on a bench. And I said, "Hey, I'm going to go sit next to you." I do. I go to sit next to this big guy. I look, and you can see he's a boy. And he puts his arm up. And she gets a picture, and I get out, and I'm thinking, great. Well, that's before digital, so we have to wait till we get home. And when we get home and develop the picture, there I am sitting there with a big grin, and he's got his arm around me, but he's got his hand in my front pocket. Stole my sunglasses. Now I know that, you know, everybody's relationships are different and stuff, and sometimes you don't bring up like old girlfriends or ex-wives. But me, I never bring up anything to do with stupidity.
Rains is an avid storyteller and has a love of knowledge, obtaining multiple graduate degrees in education as well as business. He has worked in education, law enforcement, and with NASA. He is also a published author of the biomedical thriller, A Fog Neck. Please welcome him.
Where the wild things are, car parts are expensive. I take you to the 1980s. There's a young boy being raised in the concrete jungles of East St. Louis. He has been subjected to all manners of the depravity of mankind. He has seen lust. He has seen greed. He has seen lasciviousness. He has grown into quite the wild thing. His parents, hoping to flee the horrors of the community around them, they relocate to southern Illinois, into the country. But that only increases his wildness. His Protestant grandma, hoping to save his soul, tells him that Satan is so powerful because nobody believes he exists. He takes that to heart as a young person, but not in the way that it was intended. Instead, he knows to become truly wild, he must become smart and invisible. He must be the originator of evil and not a participant. As some of you might have guessed, the story is about me. And now I take you to the turn of the century, the late 90s. It is a time of Pog, Beanie Babies, Frosted Tips, and JNCO jeans. All the cool kids have starter jackets, and every boy has a No Fear t-shirt. I have my own group of wild things now. They go by the names of Alex, Tim, and Little Mikey. Alex is 6'9". He can hide behind a telephone pole. He's a varsity basketball star and has the highest vertical jump in the state of Illinois. Tim is everything that every high school boy dreams to be. With a fully developed six-pack, can bench press 250 pounds. He has a beautiful baby face with deep-set blue eyes. And, of course, blonde tips. He's a varsity track star and a ladies' man. And Little Mikey, whose name is an oxymoron, is a big, hulking teenage boy. Lastly, there's the brainchild of this group of minions, this group of wild things, and that is myself, a 300-pound, non-athletic mastermind. And in the land of boring, I have developed a scheme to keep us entertained. We are going to dress from head to toe in camouflage. We're going to paint our faces, and we're going to get down to some mischief. The plan is simple. We are going to superadhese a refrigerator box to the middle of the road. Some of you might wonder, why would you do this thing? In my mind, it was genius. We would watch as a car drove up, and the driver both first being in surprise, and then frustration, and then even anger, as they could not remove that box from the road. By midday, everything was in full effect. The box was sealed and ready to go. We hid in a local nearby cornfield. We sat and laid amongst the prickly remains of a freshly harvested field. And we gushed over high school romances. We described our futures in the military and then how we would all come together as U.S. Marshals and rid the world of bad guys. Day disappeared and nobody came. So we decided to give up. We started to rock down the road to grab the box, and to our utter ecstasy, we saw the beams of light from the nearby vehicle. With exhilarated tenseness, we ran, we dived back into the field, and we waited in anticipation. As the vehicle approached, we noticed it was a 1990 Chevy S10 truck. As some of you might know, it's very low to the ground. The truck never stopped. When the truck hit the box did not waver, and there was an explosion of smoke and grease, and I stood up in shock as our prank had gone horribly wrong, and I watched in utter horror as the door opened up from the driver's side, and when the largest man I had ever seen got out of the driver's side, the vehicle lifted up. At this point, I turned to discuss options with my wild things. But like Casper the Friendly Ghost, they vanished. I turn around in time to hear, "Hey you, I'm gonna rip your head off." The wheels were turning slowly, and he had already gained half the distance. So I did what any scared kid would do. I ran. I ran as fast as any 300-pound non-athletic kid would run. I got to the woods. I lost him in the woods, but I could still hear him banging around. And I came to a clearing. In the clearing, I saw two things. I saw my house, and I saw my friend's house. And there they were on the porch. And I knew that all I had to do was cross that field, get to that house, because nothing can harm you on your friend's porch. I did not dare go to my house, because something far worse lived there. A steel-working Vietnam vet full of lead and vinegar. Sometimes people called him my dad. So I started to run, and the only thing that stood between me and utter safety was a small one-line electric fence, held in place by small metal poles not much bigger than the diameter of this pin. When I got to the fence, I pulled a maneuver that looked between a CrossFit and Monkey Yoga Studio. I entitle it Upward Ballerina Burpee Plank. Only Lindsay Knight, wherever he's at up there, would be proud of this maneuver. And instantly I somersaulted forward, hitting the dirt with my face, eating a mound of dirt. In shock, I tried to move, but I couldn't move. I tried to move again, but I was unable to. At this time, my friends had come running from the porch, and in the moonlight, I saw grotesque faces that reminded me of a Vincent Van Gogh painting. I looked to where their eyes met me, and there, sticking through the entire part of my leg, was that metal pole. Pain erupted in my body, and the sounds were something that you could imagine from every Arnold Schwarzenegger movie ever made. Then the scene quickly turned into William Golding's Lord of the Flies, as my minions, my friends, my wild things gathered around me and began to chant, "Pull it out." And in medical shock, I abided. And though only this much stuck out of the front, I pulled it this way. My wound was covered with dirt and grime. And as you can tell, this is a pivotal, monumental moment in my life. But I will end with this. Where the wild things are, car parts are expensive. Thank you.
Okay, so our last storyteller of the night is Shelley Lawson. She was born in San Jose, California, and she came to Kodiak for adventure and to be a volunteer naturalist for Fort Abercrombie State Park 20 years ago. For work, she teaches children about nature, and for fun, she loves to dance, hike, create, and laugh. And she would also like to add that Salmon Camp is open for lottery registration.
How'd you get that plug in? Hello, everyone. Hi. So where the wild things are, they are in Narrow Straits of Yuzinki during a small craft advisory when you're in your kayak. So, bad choices. My day off was approaching midweek, and I was going to go kayaking, and I told a friend, and he said, I can go with you. I have tomorrow off, too. And I didn't usually get to play with people during my days off because they were midweek, so I thought that'd be really fun. He said, I think we should put in at Anton Larson and kayak all the way around and come back to your ramp site. And I said, that's fun. That's something I always want to do, but it's a small craft advisory tomorrow, and I don't think we should do that. He said, but look how beautiful it is right now. It's glassy calm. I said, yeah, that's today, but tomorrow could be different. The next day, it was beautiful again out in Monashka. It was beautiful right out in front in town, and he said, let's go, let's do it. And against my better judgment, I decided to do this. So we put in Anton Larson. It was beautiful there, too. We paddled around and enjoyed our conversation, paddled up Kashiak Bay, enjoying our conversation. And then as we're getting closer to Yuzinki Narrows, I'm seeing this dark patch of water that's coming out like a channel, and I'm getting a little bit nervous. We continue on, and we round that corner into Yuzinki Narrows, and it's windy. and it's choppy, but it's still doable. So we continue paddling, and I think because he was there, we were just paddling along and not expressing our mutual nervousness. But it starts getting worse and rougher and windier, and it's picking up, and it's getting harder. We're definitely not talking at all. We're just working, and we're not making a lot of progress. And we see this rock that's kind of like a small island. We take a break behind it, and we're yelling to hear each other over the wind and the waves, and he says, "We're almost there, right? Because that's termination point, right? And then it's just Monashka, and then we're there." And I was like, "No, that is not termination point. We are not almost there." And we realized that we're not going to get to the ramp site by 5, which was our plan. His wife was going to pick us up there. And we're yelling behind the rock that she's going to call the Coast Guard. And neither of us want this to happen. He is in the Coast Guard. He wants to be a pilot, and that's his goal, and he doesn't want to mess that up. And I work for state parks, and I didn't want the Coast Guard to come rescue me unnecessarily and cause all this problem and embarrassment. And so I'm like, let's use my VHF radio, and we'll call somebody to call her and tell her not to call the Coast Guard. So I had purchased this radio because I did a lot of things by myself because I had my days off alone, and it was a fully submersible, 100% waterproof, expensive VHF radio that I had in a dry bag on the deck of my kayak. And there's a long story about how we got to use the radio. It wasn't right there, but that's longer. I took my radio out, and it had a little bit of condensation in the dry bag, and it didn't work. Nothing. The inside of the screen was all watery. It didn't work. We couldn't call. It's like, she's going to call the Coast Guard. And so we were, what should we do? And then I had this great idea. And I'm like, over there at Nelson Island, which is, you know, towards the direction we're going, but across the narrow straits, there are monks that live there. Now there's nuns, but then there was monks. And I said, they have a radio. They have a radio. They can call someone to call Lori to tell her not to call the Coast Guard. So all of this effort to, like, put ourselves in danger to avoid being rescued is making us, you know, in a situation where we might need rescuing. But it seemed like a great idea. So we went for it and started paddling across narrow straits of Yuzinki. And it starts getting worse and worse. And the wind is picking up, and the waves are getting bigger. There's huge swells. We're really committed now. We're, like, way out there. Turning around seems scary because we didn't want to get in the wrong direction of the waves. Like, we were heading the right way. And I was thinking, can we turn around? Can we go back and to this beach that we had been at? I don't know. And we just kept going and going. And the swells were bringing me up really high. And every time it did, I looked at Nelson Island, and I looked at those trees, and I wanted them to get bigger because I wanted to be closer. And I looked to see if BJ was there. And go back into the trough, and then back up again. There's the trees, there's BJ, back down. Then the waves started crashing over us and breaking on top of us. It was so windy on the top of the swells. Sometimes my paddle was getting caught in the wind, and I was afraid it was going to get ripped out. And I thought, remember, you wanted to have a spare paddle, and you didn't do that. You should have done that. And continued paddling. And we finally make it to Nelson Island. The monks are there, which was wonderful. They were so good to us. They fed us, gave us soup, and called somebody who called somebody who called Laura and told her, don't call the Coast Guard, so that worked out. And they had a radio phone. They had a radio to call Monk's Rock, and Monk's Rock called Laura. I mean, yeah, so we were set. And they called her and said, they are not coming home tonight. It is really bad outside, so they're going to be staying here tonight. Don't call the Coast Guard. So they fed us the warm soup, and then they said, hey, Shelly, we're going to have you stay somewhere else. BJ, you're staying here. We're going to have you stay in a different cabin. I was like, okay. And they gave me these giant boots to wear that were like 5 sizes too big because mine were soaked. And we leave the cabin with a flashlight. And I'm thinking we're just going to go like around the corner. But we just kept walking down this trail in the night with a flashlight. And all the way to the other end of the island is where they took me, which isn't a huge island, but it's like quarter mile, half mile down. There's this beautiful little cabin there that I got to myself. And either they had just kicked someone out, or somebody had hiked down there to build a fire because there was a fire in the stove. And it was just really quaint and lovely. The next morning, wake up, look outside, still horrible. There's a big boat going by, like pitching, bow to stern. I'm like, oh no, we're not going home today. So I hike back to where the guys are, and they say, you guys aren't going anywhere today. You're not going home anyway, but Shelly, we're taking you to where the nuns are. Okay. So between Nelson Island and Spruce Island is Sunny Cove, which is protected from the way the wind was coming in. So we all got in boats and went across. And it was one of the novice nuns' saints' days, and the monks had made a card for her. They were happy to see us. It was a nice little celebration. the monks, and BJ went away, and then I stayed with the nuns. And I'm sad to say that I maybe was stereotyping what I thought a nun would be like. They were amazing, and I related to them so much. I had a great time with them. I could have stayed there for a long time. We were doing art, and they made their own tea, and they had this garden, and they smoked salmon and dried salmon, and it was this beautiful garden. It was a lot of fun. And I'm doing some crafts with them. Then I hear this commotion, and one of the nuns comes running. She says, "Shelly, the phone's for you. There's somebody calling from Monk's Rock. Come quick." And all of us ran to the kitchen, where there's a radio phone. And on the radio phone, you have to wait. It turns talking. And it's the guy who was seeing at the time, whose name was Brent, and he's in the Coast Guard too. And he says, "We're going to come get you. My friend has a boat. It's horrible outside. It's getting worse. You should see the forecast. It's ridiculous. You're going to be there for a long time. We're going to come get you with a boat." And while he's talking, I can't talk, but I'm thinking, like, I'm not going to let him come get me. I'm a strong woman. Alaska strong. He's not rescuing me. But while I'm thinking this, the nuns start jumping on me and says, "Rescue, rescue, rescue, rescue." And they look so happy, so I say yes. They come get us. And they're like, "Yay, rescue." So it was fun for them. So many hours later, he comes. They all got their raincoats on. They all wanted to come. It was like a Disney movie that is happening in their living room. And they all went down with me and saw me off and waved, and I got home safely. BJ got home a different way safely, which is a whole different story. But he did become a helicopter pilot eventually. And the last part of my story I'll tell is I did call the radio company to tell them about my VHF radio and that it didn't work. And it got a little bit of water and it didn't work. And I was really upset. And they said, "Here it is on my kayak, the waves breaking over me in a dry bag." And I said, "Yeah, my radio doesn't work. I bought it. It's supposed to work." And he said, "Do you have sweaty palms?" "What?" "It was on my kayak, and it's supposed to be fully submersible to 30 feet. What are you talking about?" So they replaced it with a better radio. And the next year, that catalog said, "Water resistant for that radio."
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller.